As we've been reporting on HBR this morning, the state legislature is in special session this week talking about financing the Honolulu Rail Project. Part of the working agreement lawmakers have apparently reached includes an audit and annual financial reviews. Those would be done by the state. Our guests this morning say that is a terrible idea. Randy Roth and Cliff Slater, longtime opponents of the rail project. Randy Roth taught on the faculty of the UH Law School for 35 years, also produced The Price of Paradise books and radio show, and co-authored Broken Trust. Cliff Slater, a retired Hawaii businessman, chairman of HonoluluTraffic.com. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us this morning. Let's start with this concept of the audit. And Randy, what are your main issues with how these arrangements are seem to be lining up at this point?
Well, there's an obvious need for an audit, and it needs to be an audit that looks at not just the finances, but also engineering decisions and management. It needs to be what some people call forensic, which basically means you're not assuming honesty on the part of the people that are being audited. So an audit is a really, really good idea if it's done the right way. What I'm opposed to, which is part of the bill that the legislature is going to be considering, is giving another $3 billion or so, rounding it off to the nearest billion, giving another $3 billion or so to this project without first seeing the results of such an audit. And I think in addition to that kind of audit, which is a backward-looking process, what's happened already, I think there needs to be an updated alternatives analysis. So much has changed in this world in recent years. I think there needs to be another look at how can we best accomplish our community's goals with the amount of money that's available to do that. I don't think it's elevated heavy rail, but we need some independent experts to take another look at what our viable alternatives are.
And Cliff, on that idea of alternatives at this point, there is one line of argument out there that is basically, well, we are so far down the road with rail at this point that it's past the point of inevitability. There's no going back, so we might as well get it done quickly.
Right. Right. You can say that we've so far spent $3 billion. why not spend another $3 billion even if it doesn't do any good? Okay. Or in addition, if you believe Dr. Prevedoris's estimate that the whole thing will cost $13 billion, then we're talking about spending another $10 billion before this thing is completed. Do we want to spend that? What does it get there? We now recognize that the ridership projections for the city are at least double what they ought to be. So if you halve the ridership, you're going to halve the benefit, and they're only promising a 2% reduction in automobiles. So you'd have a 1% reduction, and automobile trips are increasing at 1% a year anyway. So you're not getting any benefit, and then there are the disbenefits. Okay, the ruining of our waterfront. Just the obliteration, you might say, of the view planes throughout the town.
And you will hear from the rail folks that we've been through this. We've been through these arguments. You guys have challenged this in court. The legal challenges were not successful. At the ballot box, voters went for rail. Again, the idea that the project is past the point of debate.
Okay. Well, if you go back to that time that we had a vote, the vote wasn't about a $5.3 billion project. It was about a $3.8 billion project because the city deliberately delayed putting out the draft environmental impact statement until one day before the election. Okay. They won by 50.6% of the vote. Okay, now obviously, the other 49.8% of the people were opposed to it. Now that's if you come And the other issue, of course, is the public was inundated, and most people believed that there was going to be a complete reduction of traffic congestion. That was the whole rationale for building it, as far as the public was concerned. It was only later that they found out that traffic congestion in the future would be worse, even with rail. And so, you know, they were voting on false premises, both as to the cost and as the traffic congestion. If we had a vote today on a $10 billion project, which frankly I don't believe anyway, but if it's put out at $10 billion and the traffic congestion will get worse, there will be no approval of rail.
Well, the ball where we are right now in terms of the voting on this is at the legislature in terms of the financing options and Randy, in terms of the political reality of this, of where this is. What would you say to the legislators who this week faced the discussion and the vote in terms of the rail financing?
I guess I'd begin by saying you can't make an informed decision until you know a lot more than what the city and Hart have told you so far about why in just the last year the estimated cost has jumped by about $3 billion. But I would also say there's no need to rush. The FTA is not on the verge of rushing in and grabbing the money they've already provided. For a variety of reasons, we've got a lot of time to work this out with respect to the FTA. Professor Prevedoris has talked at length about the workability of having rail stop at Middle Street and developing Middle Street even into an even better bus terminal station than what it currently is. I think as a practical matter, once the legislature's done its homework, which it can't do until it's gotten a lot more information than it has right now, I think from a political standpoint, it may be that the most attractive thing from their standpoint is to go ahead and take rail to Middle Street, but then stop it there. Save $3 to $4 billion at a minimum by stopping it there, and then spend some of that on some measures that would actually reduce traffic congestion from today's current level, as opposed to rail, which even the EIS has said isn't going to reduce it from today's current level.
And one of those arguments that I can anticipate on the other side is linked to that federal funding, saying, oh no, the federal funding, the deal is take this all the way to Ala Moana, otherwise you risk losing that federal funding.
Well, the federal funding has become a smaller and smaller and smaller percentage of what the entire project would cost. There is no instance of the FTA ever taking back all the money that it provided to a project that was terminated. Governor Christie in New Jersey terminated a project where there was no fault on the part of the FTA, and they ended up settling that for 30 cents on the dollar. In our case, FTA failed miserably in providing its statutory responsibility of giving oversight to our project. We believe it was under political pressure in those days. But the email from within the FTA that we got as a result of one of those lawsuits makes clear that they did not believe the people in Honolulu knew what they were doing in building rail, makes clear that they thought the people in Honolulu were being dishonest with the public, makes clear that they were upset that city administration was holding back the environmental impact statement until the day before the vote. And so FTA has dirty hands in this situation. There is no possibility that they will be able to take back a penny of the roughly $800 million they've already provided.
So back to Cliff, in terms of the business perspective on this, and apart from budgeting, but again, back to the assumption that there is a rail project in operation that has its momentum to the point where stopping it is again politically very, very difficult right now.
Do you think you're implying that it's at that stage right now?
I'm asking what you think, actually.
Well, I think when you put it to the public that we're currently at a stage where we've got $3 billion into it, and that realistically we've got another it will take another $10 to $12 billion to finish it. Should we stop it? Should we spend another $3 billion to take it to Middle Street? Or should we spend another $10 to $12 billion? I want to remind everybody that $10 billion is $10,000 million. Do we want to do it, or is there better things that we can do with the money, such as reduce traffic congestion?
Even with reducing traffic congestion, you're still spending that money, right? You're assuming that there's a large quantum of money that's going to get spent one way or the other. That's what I'm hearing.
Nothing like the $10 billion.
How much roughly?
$1 or $2 billion. Dr. Prevedoris has got.
That would address the traffic congestion. I mean, the initial problem is traffic, a glut of traffic going into Honolulu on every
yes,
weekday.
And now it's very difficult to get around in the city now.
Yeah.
You don't have to spend a vast amount of money to significantly improve the efficiency of the traffic lights.
Well, it's something else that Professor Prevedoris has been saying, and he's not alone. It's been in the popular press everywhere. Just in the last few years, the equation has changed dramatically with respect to self-driving vehicles and on-call vehicles. And what the media are saying, what the experts are saying, is that much sooner than what just a couple of years ago anyone was predicting, ownership of a vehicle is going to be a thing of the past, that transportation will be a service industry, and it will change dramatically the equation in terms of the number of cars that are out there at any given time, the number of cars that have to be parked at any particular point in time. And nobody knows exactly when it's coming, but you've got Apple and Tesla and Google and General Motors. You've got all these companies each putting in billions of dollars, all of them in effect saying this is coming sooner than people expected. And with these cars that are talking to each other, their computers are talking to each other, the spacing between cars, very different. The amount of space you need on each side of each car, very different. My point isn't that Professor Prevedoris or anybody else can say with certainty exactly when that is coming, but what I'm reading is that they're saying it's coming sooner than anyone thought, so it just makes sense to take that into account in deciding whether to continue spending billion after billion after billion on a rail project here that the EIS says will not reduce traffic congestion from what it is right now.
That does seem like a bit of a leap into the future, going from current congested traffic to self-driving cars. I mean, there has to be something in between. You referred to the traffic lights. What would that change?
Well, do you know the number of times that you're sitting
staggered
at the
lights.
Traffic light and nothing is happening?
Sure.
Okay. Nothing. Traffic's not going either way. There are sensors already in the streets. Okay. We have computers. We
right.
just don't, as I gather from Dr. Prevedoris, we just don't have the engineers necessary to be constantly making the adjustments. And so they are in a static mode.
In a city with staggered lights, you can just sail right down the avenue at a fixed speed. It's almost like the self-driving car phenomenon, right? You're at a 25-mile-an-hour speed limit, and you're not likely to run into any lights if you maintain...
Yeah. Significantly reduce the traffic congestion.
Does that really do it with there's only so much road?
The point is Professor Prevedoris, and we cite him because he is the local expert. He's the chair of the department
right.
at the university. He's got a long list, and that's just one of many items mm-hmm. on the list. And he has said that the total price of implementing these traffic congestion reducing strategies cumulative amount is less than $2 billion, which is a small number by comparison to what hasn't yet been spent on the train, but would if the legislature passes this bill that they're going to be looking at this week.
What are some of the others, some of the other measures that on that list?
Well, for example, you can turn shoulders into an area where certain vehicles can go. It may be just buses, but you're making more utilization of the lanes that you have right now. You've got just a host of bottlenecks out there, you know, the Middle Street merge, sure. The H1, H2 merge. And it's not rocket science to have flyovers or, you know, different ways of dealing with that. Tunneling has become far more feasible than it was just a few years ago. You may recall in the environmental impact statement for rail, they said we could tunnel. The technology is there, but it would cost too much. In the EIS, it said it would add $1 billion to the price tag. That was the stated reason for not having any tunnels. Well, with hindsight, we're looking at 10, Professor Prevedoris would say $13 billion for rail. $1 billion doesn't sound as big as it evidently did at the time of the environmental impact statement. The point is you get rid of bottlenecks like the Middle Street merge and H1, H2, and you fully utilize all of the lanes that are out there right now, and you get the traffic flowing better through smart traffic lights and what mm-hmm. have you, and you look at everything else on his list, it just makes a lot more sense than spending far more money on a train that even its proponents acknowledge isn't going to make traffic congestion better than what it is right now.
The ability, though, in order to be able to move people from west to east and east to west, but in a concentrated form on the island of Oahu, does that not have value?
Well, if you look at the EIS, traffic congestion reduction is not even a listed purpose mm-hmm. of rail.
No, I understand.
So what we're saying is let's get the experts together. We've been mentioning Professor Prevedoris. Let's get the independent, world-recognized experts together and say our purpose, right? We want to accomplish other things too, but at the top of the list is we want traffic congestion to be improved and see what they come up with. When I say an updated alternatives analysis, that's what I'm talking about. Only for the first time, let's add traffic congestion reduction to the list of purposes that we want to accomplish.
Well, you know, if people had known back in 2006, 2007, 2008, which is the main selling time leading up to the vote, if people had known that it was not a consideration for building the rail, okay, that it was more of a social justice thing, that vote would never have passed on the rail. I mean, the whole belief of people by scientific poll. There's a solid belief by the majority of the people on the island that the purpose of the rail was to reduce traffic congestion.
Gentlemen, in our remaining time, I've got to ask you both this one question that a lot of folks have said, well, you guys are just obstructionists. You know, you've been through this. You've been your suits were to no avail. The voters have spoken. What do you say to that?
That's pretty mild compared to what a lot of people said when I initially, as part of the Broken Trust group that did the Broken Trust essay, when we said that the trustees of what then was known as Bishop Estate were setting a world record for breaches of trust and that it was terribly counterproductive from the community standpoint, from the standpoint of Hawaiian children, et cetera. You should have heard some of the things that I was called. I believe rail is today's broken trust.
Yeah. When you consider that at the time of the last audit by the city auditor, okay, it's just over a year ago, 16 months, okay, at that point, the rail cost was forecast at $6.5 billion. Fast forward a year, and it's $10 billion. Nobody knows where that $3.5 billion is involved. The HART board members don't know. Obviously, the subordinates don't know. Otherwise, they would tell the HART board members. So nobody knows that. And the legislature obviously doesn't know, but they're willing to go fund this some more.
It's not incredible. Not too late to find out. Gentlemen, thank you. Randy Roth served on the faculty of the UH Law School for 35 years, received Regents Awards for community service and classroom teaching, produced the Price of Paradise books, radio show, co-authored Broken Trust. Cliff Slater, retired Hawaii businessman, chairman of HonoluluTraffic.com, when not writing about Honolulu's rail transit problem, is writing a book on the history of public transportation, ready in 2019. His hobby is photography, some of which can be seen at CliffSlater.com. Thanks to both of you for joining us this morning. The legislature hearing the rail finance bill this week, SB4, relating to the government. Our Wayne Yoshioka will be covering the latest proceedings all week long.
I'm Howard Dykus. I've been writing news stories for more than 40 years, and often the assignment is, write them short. It's harder than it looks. The shorter the story, the more editorial judgments you have to make about leaving stuff out. What I like about HPR is long stories, minutes long instead of seconds, less left out. News is more interesting that way, and more helpful. I'd tell you more, but they only gave me 29 seconds. Hawaii Public Radio. Listen and see.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, how politicians send coded signals to a target audience. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a long-ago television program that ran for four seasons on ABC. Hawaiian Eye was part of a wave of TV shows set in exotic tourist locales whose characters had lives that housebound winter audiences on the U.S. mainland could only envy. Its principals were a pair of private eyes, but it's their sidekick that we're thinking about today. She starred as the character Cricket Blake for the entire run of the show from 1959 to 1963. She was born Concetta Rosalie Ann Ingoglia in Brooklyn, New York, of Italian, Irish, German, Jewish, and Polish Jewish descent. She was a singer as well as an actress, made a couple of albums as her television persona, breaking into the top 40 with songs like 16 Reasons and Too Young to Go Steady. This morning we're looking for her name. Give us a call at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. If you know the answer, first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Chris Charbonneau from Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest and the Hawaiian Islands. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
President Donald Trump's initial response to Charlottesville read as follows. We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides. Less than a half hour later, the neo-Nazi website Daily Stormer posted these words. Trump comments were good. He didn't attack us. He just said the nation should come together. Nothing specific against us. What the Daily Stormer heard, or thought it heard, was a so-called dog whistle, a kind of secret signal of support as significant for what it didn't say as what it did. Ian Haney Lopez, a writer who lives on Oahu for part of the year, has studied the history of dog whistle politics, tracing its growth through the decades in American life. He's the author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. We spoke with him the other day.
Dog whistling can work in two very different ways.
Uh-huh.
Dog whistling can work like a secret handshake where the general audience doesn't get it, but the initiated clearly discern the meaning. And,
right.
And you see that, for example, George Bush used to talk about a culture of life or about compassionate conservatism. And
yeah.
That sounded okay to most folks, but to evangelical Christians, there was a clear meaning, right? And so this is dog whistling as a secret handshake.
Yeah, yeah.
But dog whistling about a repugnant idea like white supremacy takes a very different form. There, what's most important is to hide the underlying racism from the intended audience itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so here, dog whistling, the code in dog whistling is acting more like a self-protective lie. It's a way of telling many white voters who are racially fearful, but also deeply opposed to racism, that they're voting these higher values like patriotism or like protecting free speech, when in fact they're being mobilized and agitated by messages that focus on racial doom. You think about Make America Great Again.
Yeah.
Implicit in Make America Great Again is the message that it was great when whites were the dominant group and that it has been degraded by black equality and by non-white immigration. People embracing Make America Great Again get to tell themselves, I'm doing this because I'm a patriot, not because I'm racially fearful.
When did dog whistling become a pretty much of a mainstream political activity? You cite Reagan in particular with some of his coded messages about welfare queens.
I think dog whistling became a national phenomenon in 1972 with Richard Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
This was, you know, the era of silent majority, law and order,
right.
Opposition to forced busing. And we actually have Richard Nixon watching one of his own TV commercials on law and order and saying, that's right, that hits it right on the head. It's all about law and order and the damn Negroes and Puerto Ricans.
Mm-hmm.
That is, Nixon understood that as a result of the civil rights movement, there was a rising anxiety among many white voters that could be tapped into, but it had to be tapped into through coded racial appeals, precisely because of the civil rights movement. Open celebrations of white supremacy were not acceptable.
The target audience, Ian, being people who would consider it vulgar to use the N-word or to get out on the street with a billy club, but had the same kind of attitudes, a little bit more hidden, yeah?
I think that's right. I would say it's folks who have deeply internalized messages about the importance of white identity, about, you know, the decency of white folks, the threat posed by people of color, the idea that cultures associated with non-whites are inferior, but people who have those as deep, unconscious, even common sense beliefs, but who consciously believe that open racism is morally reprehensible. And so these are people who would be very quick to repudiate anybody who used the N-word,
mm-hmm.
but who are nevertheless sympathetic to people who talk about thugs and criminality and welfare abuse as a way of life in the, quote, inner cities. Okay, so all of these are codes that trigger imagery of black depravity that works for people even when consciously they would reject white supremacist language and offensive racial epithets.
Well, since this whole movement started, we found out that there are a lot of people like that, right?
Yes. Yes. Although, well, when you say a lot of people like that, you mean the white supremacists or the...
No,
or the
I mean
people?
The, you know, the more polite sympathizers of white supremacy who would, as you say, would never use the N-word, would never identify themselves openly as racist, but would be distinctly uncomfortable about, you know, a crime or even someone in their country club.
Or how about distinctly responsive to a politics that appeals to them mm-hmm. through coded messages of racial resentment?
Sure.
We have found out that there are a lot of people in this sense. It's a majority of whites. And here's what's startling. No, since dog whistling started, no Democratic candidate for president has won a majority of the white vote. So this isn't just Donald Trump.
Yeah.
No Democratic candidate for president has won a majority of the white vote since Lyndon Johnson in 1964 when he signed the Civil Rights Act.
So there's votes to be had, money to be made by embracing this whole perspective, isn't there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm so glad you actually you raised the question of money.
Yeah, well, you can't go too far talking this without talking about money, can you?
Yeah, exactly. As with just about everything in politics, at the end of the day, politics lives and dies by the aphorism, follow the money.
Right.
And what's happening here is, and this actually goes back to the 1930s, business interests were threatened by a federal government that was aggressively regulating the marketplace in favor of regular people.
Mm-hmm.
They also realized that they could find common cause with segregationists and white supremacists who were threatened by a federal government that was insisting on integration. And so from the 1930s still through today, there is a common alliance between big business interests and family dynasties who use racial appeals to convince average people that big government is their enemy. And in fact, what you see is people using this, corporations using this populism, the Koch brothers, Fox News, using this populism to build popular support for politicians who basically serve the interests of the billionaire class. And this is Donald Trump to a T. So Donald Trump isn't just dog whistle politics in the sense of being an aggressive race baiter. He actually symbolizes both elements, aggressively using race to build support for a president and a presidency who primarily serve the interests of the very rich, the billionaire class, Goldman Sachs, Exxon Mobil, the various billionaires who make up the Trump cabinet.
Is it working? It's working, right?
It is working.
Yep.
It's working. It's working all too well. I think a lot of people are focused on the stalled legislation in Congress. But meanwhile, what you're seeing administratively are big rollbacks in regulations of the market that protect all of us, and that actually these rollbacks work to the benefit of high-income individuals, corporations that want to pay lower taxes, corporations that want to be free from environmental regulation or regulations prohibiting monopoly. The very rich are making out like bandits.
Ian Haney Lopez, a writer who lives on Oahu for part of the year, is the author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
Homeless have always been problematical, vulnerable to constitutional challenges, difficult to enforce, seen as criminalizing homelessness. At best, they've been seen as a temporary measure intended to move the homeless into shelters. So why, then, has Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell signed into law yet another bill that expands the boundaries of Honolulu's sit-lie ban? Civil Beat reporter Rui Kaneda has more in today's Reality Check. Hi, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
This does seem to be going against the trend of most proffered solutions to homelessness, doesn't it?
In many ways it does, but, there are quite a bit of pressure from folks like, the Hawaii Tourism Authority, those folks who are concerned that, places like Waikiki are over, there are too many homeless folks over there, and they just have to do something about it, and this is one way to tackle that issue.
Well, let's say if within that area I'm sitting on a park bench reading a book and I fall asleep, am I in violation?
Technically, I think you are.
Yeah.
There have been quite a few citations written because of that activity like that. I don't have the exact figure off the top of my head, but something like 20,000 citations that have been issued since the sit-lie took effect around 2015.
I'm betting that if I'm reasonably well-dressed, I'm not going to get rousted from that park bench. Is that true?
Well, I don't know. I haven't done the observation of actual people being cited. That's something that I would like to do. If they can actually let me in on observing those activities, that would be great if I can tag along a police officer. But, that is something that I'd like to totally see. And folks like the ACLU, they probably would like to see that as well.
Well, but it does, that's one of the whole issues with regarding to sit-lie, isn't it? I mean, how do you identify who it is you want to move along?
Right. That's one of the key issues. And also, if you ban people from doing things like sitting in line in one place, and if you keep expanding that particular area to farther and farther from places like Waikiki, then at what point are you actually making the law that actually makes being homeless a crime instead of, supposedly protecting the commercial activities in those areas? And, folks like the SAU would say, well, by expanding and expanding and expanding, and by the way, this is the fifth time that the sit-lie ban has been expanded, then, you might get to the point where you are actually making it a crime to be homeless. There are a case in 2006 in which the Ninth Circuit decided a case that involved the LA ordinance, and that was a citywide, but basically very close to what we have here. And the Ninth Circuit basically said, yeah, you just cannot have that kind of law and at the same time not have enough places for these people to go, because by doing that, essentially you are making it a crime. Now, our law here in Honolulu, it only applies selectively, right? The places like Waikiki downtown and selective areas around Oahu. So, but if you try to expand this further and further into the areas that are not very commercially, a lot of commercial activities, then you can make an argument in court saying, look, judge, this is, the intent of this is not really about protecting the commercial activities, but to criminalize homelessness.
Well, given that what you described with the Ninth Circuit decision means that there's a pretty clearly established precedent against this measure, so why proceed with it if you're only going to invite a legal challenge?
I think the city officials are very much aware of it. The Mayor Caldwell makes a point of saying, we should enact a sit-lie only in areas that are that have the commercial activities. But back in 2015, the city council actually overrode his veto because this is Bill 6. And it included areas that are zoned apartment or residential area. mayor thought that was, you know, the wrong idea, but city council thought it was still a good measure because, you know, they were getting a complaint from their constituents and saying, hey, look, you know, our area is overridden by homeless folks. So they're kind of dancing at that area. You know, I think some of them are already kind of conceding that, yeah, we're going to face the legal challenge somehow, but I think they think that this is still a good way to go.
I suspect there are more stories to emerge from this, and I thank you for keeping us abreast of it. We'll be checking back in with Civil Beat. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Louis Caneda.
Planning for the future is an important part of everyone's life, but when it comes to governments, those plans carry an impact that can affect thousands of people. A couple of communities in Maui County are updating their future planning, and residents on Molokai and Lanai are getting a chance to weigh in. Kalina Wetchi is a reporter for the Maui News and a contributing reporter here at Hawaii Public Radio, and she joins us now with a little perspective. So, Colleen, any planning discussion is going to have some competing viewpoints. How's this one going so far?
Well, they've gotten a lot of that out of the way so far. First, the planning, the community plan had to go to this 13-member community plan advisory committee, so they had to hold a lot of public meetings, and a lot of issues were fleshed out at that point. Then it went to another body, the Molokai Planning Commission. So we've already had a lot of these meetings where we've asked people, what are your opinions on some of these issues, and what do you want to see in this community plan? So this is the last stage, and hopefully the council can get through this before the end of the year, which is their deadline. So, yeah, definitely there's been some back and forth in the community over the past few years, but we're nearing the end point on this one.
So what are some of the issues that have emerged as consensus or frequently talked about as concerns for long-term planning?
For Molokai, the issue is always maintaining the character of the island. In the community plan, the Molokai community calls itself the last Hawaiian island, and it's true in so many ways. I mean, it's very rural. People still rely on subsistence fishing and hunting and have a very close relationship to the land. So a lot of these plans stem from trying to keep that, trying to keep Molokai Molokai. So there are a lot of talk about, you know, making sure we protect the natural resources, making sure we take care of the fish ponds and restore some of these natural resources and that sort of thing. And there's also talk about development, where that can and can't happen. Development isn't really a big thing on Molokai. There aren't any high rises or that sort of thing. So one of the things that has come up is short-term rentals, mm-hmm. and the Molokai community doesn't really want to see any short-term rentals on the island. There already are some, but actually at a planning commission meeting recently, they decided to say we don't want any short-term rentals.
Flooding and sea level rise, those are a couple of concerns that now are playing out on a level that even just a few years ago was very different. How's that playing out in the planning process?
Yeah, this plan actually has a lot of projects that approach sea level rise and flooding because Kaunakakai, which is where a lot of the businesses are and a lot of the homes are, that's some parts of it are in a flood zone, as well as the east end of Molokai as well. So some of these projects will address that, such as finishing the Kaunakakai drainage system, which is supposed to be completed next year. And they also need to move the police station because that's in a flood zone as well. And they also want to move the Puka'o fire station, which is in the east end of Molokai. So there's a lot of plans to move different facilities and figure out where we should put some of these things because with sea level rise being a concern, maybe not in the next 10 years, maybe not in the next 20 years, but it is something that the Molokai community does have to keep in mind for the future.
You did a story very recently quoting Planning Director Will Spence saying his department's really stressing what he calls fiscal reality. So what's that mean, and how's that showing up in these planning discussions?
Yeah, so in the past, a lot of these plans didn't have prices or estimated costs for a lot of these projects. So they just throw a bunch of things together and say, this is what we want to see in the community, but there were never any estimated costs for it. So it wasn't completely realistic in terms of the budget. So now with these new community plans that they're trying to update, and Molokai is one of the earlier ones, they're trying to put in these estimated costs so we can say, okay, what's realistic, what can we make a priority, and to make sure that these projects actually happen and they're not just wish lists that are floating around and never get implemented. So that's a big thing, because implementation is also a huge issue. A lot of people say, hey, we spend all this time making these community plans, and then we don't go through with them and don't do these projects. And so the planning department is trying to do a better job of that, trying to monitor these projects, make sure they happen, and to make sure that we have the money for them as well.
Paying for them as well, looking ahead on Molokai. Thank you, Colleen. Aloha and mahalo for that.
Thanks so much, Bill.
Colleen Oechi is a reporter for the Maui News and a contributing reporter for Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for Stargazer comes from Urgent Care Hawaii, walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki, featuring ZipPass, a new online tool to secure a place in line. AmazingUrgentCare.com. Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet, and also what we can try and observe in our dark island skies. As usual, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips, and we've got him on the line right now. Welcome back, Christopher. What's in store for us this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be back. So this week, Stargazers, look out for the planet Jupiter as it begins to get lower in the sky towards the west after sunset. This week, the moon will be waxing, which means it'll be getting slightly brighter as the week goes on, so stargazing should still be good till the weekend.
You've got very exciting news on a discovery that ended up producing the first detailed image of another star.
That's right. During the summer months here in Hawaii, we are treated to an incredible vista, that of the galactic center of our Milky Way galaxy. You can see it in the south once the sun sets, and it resembles a misty river of stars reaching across the heavens. One of the brightest stars is called Antares, or as we know it here in Hawaii, Lehuakona. It lies in the constellation of Scorpius, which we know as Kamakau Nui o Maui. Astronomers using the Very Large Telescope in Chile have captured the most detailed images of Antares ever taken.
So this is pretty amazing. Normally we don't get to see stars up close.
Well, as you know, the problem with directly imaging other stars in our galaxy is that they are very far away. Even a huge star can look like a tiny pinprick with the largest of telescopes.
How'd they do it?
Well, this was all down to the Very Large Telescope itself, which isn't actually one telescope at all. It consists of 4 8-meter telescopes with several smaller telescopes around it. And the cool thing about the VLT is that it is able to link these telescopes to mimic a larger telescope.
And so the image they'll do is sort of a composite from all of the telescopes in one giant image.
That's right. It's incredibly complicated, though, because the timing between the telescopes has to be just right.
If they're linking them all together, how big of a telescope, in terms of the power of the thing, are they able to create?
Amazingly, they were able to mimic the presence of a 200-meter telescope, and that's how they were able to capture these incredible images.
One of which we've got at HawaiiPublicRadio.org, where we keep Stargazer online.
That's absolutely right.
And we appreciate you getting us that. It's Christopher Phillips. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week for Stargazer.
Aloha, I'm Aiden James from Honolulu. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we thought about the former Concetta Rosalie Ann Ingoglia, who starred in the ABC television series Hawaiian Eye from 1959 to 1963. The show benefited from several factors. Hawaii was a brand new state in 1959 and was experiencing a huge boost in tourism that was aided by newly inaugurated jetliner flights to the islands. Real estate mogul Henry Kaiser, whose Kaiser's Hawaiian Village, as it was then called, was the setting for the show, lent his promotional efforts to the enterprise. The actress we're thinking of today was the girl Friday to the show's stars, a pair of private detectives played by Robert Conrad and Anthony Isley. Her character, Cricket Blake, was supposed to be a photographer who also sang in the hotel bar, and she was played by Connie Stevens.
And Randy Kim of Mililani knew that one, and boy, so did a lot of other folks. Our producer Lillian says that we have more than 10 folks calling in. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa.
Next time on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll catch up with Project Imua, which recently launched its third mission from NASA's flight facility in Virginia.
We'll hear the lessons learned on this project to send a payload carrying data collecting experiments into space.
That's next time on Bite Marks Cafe, Wednesday at 6:30 p.m.
Last week, we had an issue recording the show. Fortunately for us, News Exposure captured the hour, donated the recording to HPR. We'd like to thank Client Relations Manager Craig Travitz of News Exposure. That's it for today. Tomorrow, we'll continue our week-long look at the rail story with a view from off-island. Mel Raposo will join us. He's the chair of the Kauai County Council, a declared candidate for mayor, perspective on the Honolulu Rail from a neighbor island. Tomorrow.
We like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Bill Dorman. Aloha.